Hello, everybody. We're trying to finish up here our last article before the conclusion of the Augsburg Confession. This is on the power of the bishops. By the way, Happy New Year. New Year, same me, same problems. So let's look here. This is starting off at paragraph one. We confess. Consequently, according to divine right, it is the office of the bishop to preach the gospel, to forgive sin, to judge doctrine and reject doctrine that is contrary to the gospel, and to exclude from the Christian community the ungodly whose ungodly life is manifest, not with human powers, but with God's word alone. So we want to look at this in this way, right? We're coming off of this first, let's say, half. It's kind of more like a third that we've covered so far. But what's been confessed already is the main concern with the bishops of the day. Well, first of all, you had that sort of, well, let's put it this way. On one hand, you have this red thread that's been running through the entire Augsburg Confession. Everything needs to be brought in subjection to the gospel of the forgiveness of sins freely given in Jesus Christ by his blood, faith receiving that, if you want to get all, nitpicky about it and whatever. But as is seen with the distinction between foods, as is seen with the celibacy thing, as is seen with the traditions of men, as is seen with, every single thing that we've seen already in the disputed errors, now you're seeing here as well in the power of bishops. It was understood that this thing, which, is a natural outgrowthing of human tradition as it regards proper ordering of human society according to what is most effective in the context. And then they said, now you have to do this, or else if you're not in subjection to this bishop. And what they meant by bishop was not bishop in the biblical sense, in which sense all pastors are bishops, but the sense in which it's really quite silly. You have a pastor who is just, again, through the natural outgrowth of human society. You have, for example, a congregation, and you have one pastor, but then the congregation starts to grow. By the way, you have deacons too, but then your congregation starts to grow. They need to call a second pastor to keep up with the amount of work, the amount of people that need care, the amount of services that are being conducted. And then you have two pastors, then you have three. And so what you'll have is you'll have a senior pastor, and then you'll have your assistant pastors, right? This is literally what was going on in the early church. And this is, by the way, this is the same sort of thing that was going on in the synagogues, that was going on in the Jewish communities as well, where you would have a head rabbi, so to speak, and others following him, not because he was a different ordination, a different order of clergy, but because he was the leading, the most predominant, the smartest, the oldest, the wisest, the most experienced, blah, 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 whatever. And so this thing, which is fine, it's good really to have that. Then when you get multiple congregations growing up, you're going to have one who, this is just for example, a circuit. You're going to have a circuit counselor, circuit visitor. Then you're going to have a whole district, you're a diocese. You're going to have your district president or your bishop, right? But what is this? Well, he's the pastor that's either, you can be a pastor in charge of a small portion of a congregation, a pastor in charge of a whole congregation and the assistant clergy under you. You can be a pastor that's also in charge of, for example, your circuit, your district, your diocese, or you can be, for example, a synod president. These are literally the same ideas. But what happened was they said, no, you can only be a bishop if three bishops have laid their hands on you. And if they didn't have three hands laid on them by bishops, then they aren't bishops. Then you're not a bishop because you didn't have the hands laid on by the specific guys who had hands laid on. And I'm not saying any hands. Obviously, you need hands. That's how you do an ordination. What I'm saying is the rule of having three bishops, defined as someone who's had three bishops lay hands on them at once, is entirely made up. Now, is it there for good reason? Yes, it's there for good reason. It's there so that you can have the unity of the bishops in successing that line forward. Sorry, my brain's not working really good today. So that you don't have, for example, if you have a dispute between two bishops, one bishop going off and making another one to stack the odds in his favor. So you can't have this ridiculous kind of behavior. You need unity, you need consensus, you need teamwork in making bishops, in running a church. That's why that exists. However, this became blown out of proportion in the Roman understanding, and now it was absolutely necessary for the legitimacy of the church and the validity of the grace of God as it comes through the means of grace, the word and sacrament. And so they had said the church revolves around this officer, the bishop, right? And you find this idea in the church fathers as well. Let's not pretend you don't. Let's not pretend you don't at all, right? However, I guess you'd say the dispute, the argument that we're having with those folks who are reading those texts in the fathers is, well, what is meant there? Is what's meant there that the word and sacrament are around the bishop because they flow out of him? I mean, technically they do, right? Or is it that the church revolves around the bishop because the word and sacrament flow out of him? If that distinction makes sense to you. Such to say, does the church revolve around word and sacrament, with the officer of the church being the dispensing instrument thereof? Or does it flow out of the bishop and word and sacrament are, how do you say, adjuncts or accessories onto this sort of fellowship and unity of the church, right? Obviously, there's going to be some level of cohesion between the bishop, the officer, and the word and sacrament, which is instituted to give, to dispense. However, the question is not just which thing is most predominant, most important, but which is the essential source, right? And this is what you'll find when you go into, for example, the Apology of the Augsburg Confession later on when we get there, and we're talking about the number of sacraments. Melanchthon says he's fine to consider ordination a sacrament so long as it is properly understood, understanding that its value is in the word and sacrament that it's instituted for, right? Rather than saying word and sacrament have value insofar as they are in connection to the officer, the bishop. And really, in the Roman mind, at least since Vatican I, those bishops only have value insofar as they're in submission to Rome, right? Or connection to Rome, you should say. Because they also do understand that there's a value of the Orthodox patriarchs, even though they're not in submission to Rome. but they have some relationship to Rome. Rome does acknowledge them. And by that acknowledging them, they understand that they're sort of not dispensing, but there's a unitive value there. So this is good, right? Consequently, according to divine right, it is the office of bishop to preach the gospel, to forgive sin, to judge doctrine, and reject doctrine. So on. All this stuff is good. And this stuff might seem like, well, this is the rebukey stuff. Yeah, but it's rebuking stuff that is taking away from the free forgiveness of sins. And then you have the exclusion from the Christian community, the ungodly, whose ungodly life is manifest, not with human power, force, or the sword, that means, right? But with God's word alone. All of this is law and gospel ministry, ministry of the word. Now, what the bishops of Rome were doing was they were getting their hands tied up in the left-hand realm, kingdom of the world. And what they were doing there was saying basically, we are politicians that are over the state, right? And so they were taking up the task of the sword. They were also not doing the thing, the only thing they were there to do, which is to forgive sin. Instead, what they were doing was engaging in this indulgence business, such that you would pay them for the forgiveness of sin, or such that you would, for example, buy the forgiveness of sin, such that you would work for it via penance, and all of these sorts of things, right? None of that is part of the office of the ministry, but it is against it. And so to come back to this, what is the problem that we've dealt with so far? Well, it's really this twofold idea. One, that they're not doing their task of word and sacrament. Two, well, I should say of the gospel, because they were administering the sacraments, but they weren't doing it rightly. So I mean, there's always nitpicky things that we could talk about, but in a very broad sweeping way, the main issue is that they're not administering the gospel of forgiveness freely given. What they are doing is going against it, and they're engaging in all these things that God didn't give them to do, such as operating as tools of the state and politicians and so on. Now, he says, that is why parishioners and churches owe obedience to bishops according to the saying of Christ. Whoever listens to me, to you listens to me. And this is something that we need to pay more attention to. This idea that you'll hear thrown around in Lutheran churches, we don't need to obey the bishops because we have the word we're lay led, people will say. People will say the LCMS is a lay led institution, which is definitionally not true. But they'll say, well, laity are the only thing that saved the LCMS from Seminex. You know, whatever one believes about this thing, you come back to the confessions. No, you do owe obedience, not just to bishops, but to bishops in the biblical sense. You owe obedience to pastors. You owe obedience to those outside of the church, to the state. You owe obedience to police. You owe obedience to your parents, and not just obedience, but honor and love, respect, honor, right? These things are owed first to father and to mother, to state and to governor, to teacher and to employer, and they are obeyed to pastors and bishops, to district presidents and synod presidents. And so we shouldn't have this sort of attitude of, well, I'm just going to do whatever I want because I'm free in Christ. That's not freedom, right? That's schism, right? That's not good. We can't have that behavior. But what the Book of Concord is saying that we need to do, what Melanchthon here and the Augsburg Confession is saying we need to do, we need to have a disposition of alignment, a disposition of obedience, right? And that's a scary word for a lot of Lutherans for some reason, obedience. But maybe I can even switch the word and make it easier for you. You need to have a disposition of submission to the belief that those above you care for you. Let's just start with that. All right. It's a good place to start, right? Instead of saying, I'm not going to do whatever my bishop says or believe whatever my bishop says or whatever my pastor says unless I agree with him. That's not a disposition to submission to anything except yourself. And there is a good, I've written on this. If you want to go and look at the Transcendent Truth Media blog, you can find there's an article on the good of submission. And I believe that that's written around, it's either Irenaeus or Ignatius's letters, I forget who, but there's a good there that we need to be careful not to lose, right? And it's rooted in the good of authorities care for us and love. When it's done rightly. But whenever they teach or institute, or, and this is why I added that clarification, or introduce something contrary to the gospel, we have God's command not to be obedient, right? So there's, you know, this is not hard to understand as long as you hold these two things in your hands and say, yeah, not everything is all the time, yes, all the time. We have a disposition towards submission to those in authority over us, especially a disposition to submit to the belief that they will our good. But when it's evident that they do not, then that disposition, right? It's not that it goes away, it's that it's proven to be accepted, right? There's an exceptional circumstance before us. So, then he adds these texts. We should all know these texts, and I think that we do. We kind of have the opposite problem, though, right? But you have to understand here, Paul, who's quoted, Jesus, who's quoted, and Melanchthon himself, who's writing this, does not say, when the bishop institutes something you don't like, or he doesn't even say, when the bishop institutes something unnecessary that you find is gaudy, that you find is distasteful, disobey him. No, he doesn't say that. He says when he institutes something that's contrary to the gospel. So again, this red thread throughout all the disputations against the errors in the Augsburg Confession is not about whether you like it or not, whether it's necessary or not, whether it's divine or merely human or not. It's always only ever about the gospel and the law. That's it, right? And so if your bishop tells you we're going to be gay or something, don't you can't submit to that, right? Or if the bishop says you need to, for example, do penance to receive the forgiveness of sin, that's contrary to the gospel. You can't submit to that. But if he says, for example, I need you to let's give one that people really love to make a stink about, right? I need you to come to Bible study. I need you to, for the sake of the church, not for your forgiveness, but for the sake of the church, for the strengthening of your brethren, I need you to help out and be present there. right? People will say, oh, I'm not going to submit to that. God didn't say that. No, you need to slow down. Right? You need to slow down. First of all, especially because that is within the law of God, to be one who's busy about studying the scriptures, busy about being unified in the work of the church, unified in the strengthening of the brethren. These are actually things that are commanded of you by God, right? Maybe not in the particulars, but in many cases, bishops, pastors, deacons, church authorities, they're not going to tell you to do these random, hurtful, harmful sorts of things. They're going to ask you to do things, though, that you won't want to do. Right? And many times they're going to ask you to do less of those things because they know that you'll act up if they ask you to do as many as they should, right? So we need to really change our disposition here and say, that guy has dedicated his whole life to serving me and people like me. Probably he wills my goat. Just simply start there, and I think the rest of it, by God, will flow out. Okay? So now he cites here canon law. He says, canon law also commands in the same part, in part two, question seven, in the chapters entitled Priests and Sheep. And St. Augustine writes in the letter against Papillion that one should not obey bishops, even if they have regularly been elected, whether when they err or teach or command something contrary to the holy divine Scripture. Now, we need to be careful here. What's the standard here that's being spoken of? Because oftentimes I'll be speaking to young guys, and they'll have this idea that comes from like apologetics seen on YouTube, and they'll be talking about like, well, what if my pastor says something I disagree, or what if I study and I find out that I don't really agree with Lutheranism? And they're usually talking like the referent of the conversation is some kind of highly in-depth thing about diatheletism and monothelitism and miaphysitism. And it's like, who, what makes you think that you're authorized to have an opinion about that, right? That's not what's being spoken of. What's being spoken of here are very simple gospel truths, law and gospel truths, right? If your bishop is telling you that sexual immorality is not a sin, then you cannot obey them. Right. Or if they tell you that, for example, you cannot be forgiven until you do five jumping jacks and 17 Hail Marys, you cannot receive that. That's not acceptable. That's not true. Right. And this is what the canon law, this is what Saint Augustine are getting at when they say it's not just about the gospel, but about the Holy Scriptures. You have to read that in understanding. No, like have within your mind some common sense here, friends. What is important, knowable, and clear in the Holy Scriptures? People will say, yeah, well, the debates about monothelitism and diatheletism are clear in the Scriptures. Look, maybe you think that. I'm not saying they're not. I'm just saying, I don't think high schoolers are capable of solving issues that split the church 1500 years ago, personally. So maybe that's a crazy thing for me to think and say, I don't know. So whatever other power or jurisdiction bishops have in various matters, such as marriages and tithes, they have them by virtue of human right. Of human right. Now, this is really interesting and key for us to understand. So when we talk about the right of pastors to be paid to have tithes, when we talk about pastors being able to do marriages, right? These, he's saying, are not divine. These are of human right. That doesn't mean they're wrong. For example, the matter of tithes and tithing, Luther understands as being related to Paul's commands, Paul's words, let's say. But when the Book of Concord's dealing with something that is of apostolic source, does not attribute it divine source. It distinguishes between the two. Not that you're free to not do it, but it does distinguish. There is a difference in source here. So you'll also see that when I think it is in this article when it's brought up about the choosing of Sunday for church fellowship and worship. When we're talking about the festal cycle and the sanctoral cycle, when we're talking about even the wearing of veils on ladies, it does bring that up as well as an example here. And that makes a lot of us uncomfortable, and I think rightly so. Not that we should disagree with it, but I think our discomfort is coming from a place of piety, which is a good thing. but we need to be careful to understand what's being said here. It doesn't mean that you can't do that. You can just choose to not do these things. Luther would not find that acceptable. Melanchthon would not find that acceptable if you said, we're just not going to have, for example, even bishops. That's not an acceptable opinion to them. That was something that was done temporarily by them out of necessity. It's not something that they chose, not something that they willed, not something that they said, yeah, this is a good idea. And when they went without them, what they did was they set up the exact same system without the three hands being applied to the one guy, right? Or, well, I guess it's six hands, right? Same system because the system is good. That's the idea. Now, as for marriages, right, people will say, well, marriage is a churchly thing. It has to happen in a church. I understand that position. However, the Book of Concord is saying that it is not of divine source. And we know that it's not of divine source to be the case because God instituted marriage before the church as an institution for all creation, such that when, for example, two Muslims show up and they convert, we don't say you have to get married now. No, we say you are married, that you're already married. It doesn't matter if you're married as a Christian, as a Muslim, marriage is a universal sort of command, which is why, one of the reasons why we do not consider it a sacrament. He says, though, however, when bishops neglect such duties, princes are obligated, whether they like it or not, to administer justice to their subjects for the sake of peace in order to prevent discord and great unrest in their lands. So he's tying together what, not together as in into one, but together as in teamwork, the right hand and the left hand kingdoms, as they're often called, right? The state and the church. When the church is not doing the duties that it has, such as, for example, let's say charity, it's not taking care of the poor, then yes, the state should step in. But it's not the job of the state, even though we've now flipped that around. For whatever reason, many people will now say, no, charity, taking care of kids, education, these are all tasks of the state. When they're not done, then the church should take over. But this is actually backwards, right? So, furthermore, it is also debated whether bishops have the power to establish ceremonies in church as well as regulations concerning food, festivals, and different orders of the clergy, as we had just referenced, right? Now, this idea is sort of nuanced here, whether bishops have the authority, not whether the church has the authority. And there's a big distinction there. Obviously, all these things had to come from the church in some way or rather, except for, let's say, the last one, the different orders of clergy. There is a decent opinion, which is not held by me, but it is a decent opinion such that the church has no power to distinguish within the offices of the church, right? Now, I don't think that we have the possibility of inventing new orders of clergy, such to say, not that this is really ever done. I'm just trying to think of an example here. I guess this might be done with the DCE. Although the DCE is really not like that. I think there's probably some debate over trying to narrow down those terms across church bodies, and that's kind of for this reason. Should we be inventing new orders of clergy? I don't think so. But is it totally fine to distinguish within them and say you're going to have a senior pastor, you're going to have an assistant pastor, you're going to have a bishop or a district president or a synod president, or within the deacons, you're going to have an archdeacon, or you're going to have a deaconess, or I guess the DCE would be like a deaconess that's set apart for education or something, some sort of something for music, right? In a sense, these are not supposed to be new offices. These are really distinguishing factors within that one sort of office, whether that be the office of the ministry of word and sacrament or the office of the diaconate and humanitarian sort of aid and service and counseling and these sorts of things. Now he says, for those who grant bishops this power, that is this power apart from the church alone, right? Hold on, I'm receiving a phone call here. Okay, well, where were we? Let's see here. Okay, talking about yes, the distinctions. as to whether they have authority to do this apart from the church, or whether it's, as we said, the church does do this. The question is, do they have authority? This is really the question. Apart from the church, or is there authority from within the church as a not a delegate, but a spokesperson, a spokesman for that collective body of the Christian community? Is the spokesman of the Christian community the bishop? Or is the bishop allowed to do whatever the bishop thinks needs to be done for the good of that church? Now, I'm not saying, don't think I'm biased here. I'm not saying that one is better than the other. I'm saying, what is the reality, right? Because if it is true that the bishop has authority to do this apart from the church, then it's emphasizing that fatherly nature. The father doesn't ask his children for permission to take care of the children. The children don't know how to take care of themselves. And I'll tell you straight up, like within, and mind you, this isn't talking about the pastor as bishop. This is talking about what we would call a district president, right? A bishop in that sense, in the administrative sense, a pastor of pastors, if you will, right? Obviously, within the pastoral office congregationally, you have to have authority to do what the congregation needs you to do for their sake, and you can't be asking them for permission to do that. However, there's also a kind of unitive element here because the authority the pastor has to do that comes from the call placed upon him by the congregation. But still, we need to be careful to not say, as some congregations believe, that because of that, a pastor needs to ask permission to do the things he's already commanded by God to do as a pastor, right? Let me give you a great example here that no one wants me to bring up. Weekly communion. Now, at St. Matthew's Lutheran, we have always done weekly communion, so this is not a problem that I deal with in my real life, but I have at previous parishes before I was a pastor. So, as a layman, pastor's not giving you communion. Okay, right. I know this is not something I dealt with long. This is something that I for a very brief period of time, or 6 months, I was at a church that didn't have communion every week. This was also in the COVID pandemic, so it's a bit of a different sort of situation. However, that being said, you'll talk to many pastors about this, and they'll all say, all unanimously, yeah, we want to bring in weekly communion because not only is it good and necessary in an evangelical sense, but it's part of the Book of Concord. In the Augsburg Apology 24, paragraph 1. Okay, so should we do that? Yeah, we should do that. But a lot of them don't. And they'll say that the reason why is because their congregations aren't ready for it. Right? They want to wait till their congregations give them the go-ahead. My sort of question, like I understand wanting to be gentle. What are you waiting for them to give you permission for to do the task you're called to by God? To obey your ordination vows? To be a confessional Lutheran? To take care of them? I just don't get, I don't get it, right? We're not talking about the color of the rug here. If we were, I would understand. If we were talking about your salary, I would understand. If we were talking about anything else that wasn't as simple and clear-cut as we need to do communion, right? Then I would understand. But that why do they do that? They do that because of this idea that they think that they have not just not qualified this correctly. They think that their authority depends upon the consent constantly, the constitutive, constant, continual consent of the sheep to be fed. That's insane, right? Right? I mean, if you have kids, you know that's insane. I have kids, and sometimes my kids don't want to eat dinner. Sometimes they want to eat candy instead. Sometimes they say, we don't want to eat anything. Oh, sorry, that's not acceptable. Sometimes they say, we don't want to get dressed. We want to wear pajamas all day. Sometimes at night, when they have been wearing pajamas all day, they say, we want to put on clothes now, right before bed. No, I can't. I can't. Sorry. We need to have sensible care for those who need to receive it. And for those who are giving it, a sensible way of using that authority. But when we're talking about bishops in the sense of this article of the Augsburg Confession, we are talking about district presidents. What can they do? What can those kinds of bishops do? Can they invent new festivals? Can, apart from the church, can they make distinctions concerning foods as fasting regulations without the consent of the church, without gathered collective of the church? Now it says, for those who grant bishops this power, cite this saying of Christ. I have many things to say to you, but you cannot hear them now. When the Spirit of truth comes, he'll guide you into all truth. They say, this Spirit of truth is bishops. This Spirit of truth is the continuing authority of church tradition. So, and they also cite this example, Acts 15, 20, and 29, where the eating of blood and food sacrificed to idols is prohibited. They appeal to this as well as to the transfer of the Sabbath to Sunday. We brought this up earlier, as they view it, right? Which they think was done by the church's will through the bishop, right? Obviously, we know that this was an apostolic thing because it's already happening. It's already happening within the first week of the resurrection. It's already happening. So, as they view it, no other example is so strongly emphasized and quoted as the transference of the Sabbath. Thereby, and this is dangerous because they believe that what they're doing is nullifying and changing the law of God and making it a different day, but still retaining its sabbatical legal nature. This is not the reality, though. The reality is that the church can meet on a different day. However, it's not fair to say, for example, that we do this merely as a traditional thing. This is an apostolic thing, but even when it's an apostolic thing, that's when Christ was meeting them in the resurrection on the Sundays, right? That's where we see it in scripture. So, in a sense, this is a Christ thing, and it is apostolic. More than it's just, oh, well, it's just traditional. It's just, we just decided to do that for good order. Like, yes, we did, but this was already connected to the Easter appearances. This is already connected to the apostolic witness of the Easter appearances. And when we celebrate on Sunday, we're drawing ourselves into concordant union with that apostolic witness of the Easter resurrectional appearances. Okay? So, thereby, they want to maintain that the power of the church is so great because it has dispensed with an altered part of God's Ten Commandments. Now, coming back to earlier, the point, what is Melanchthon's concern always, all the time, and forever in the Augsburg Confession regarding these things? It is the law and it is the gospel. That's it. It's not something, it's not like, oh, well, you just made that up. And then he gets really mad that you made it up. No, it's that you made something up that runs contrary to God's command or runs contrary to forgiveness for sin by God's gospel. He says, concerning this question, our people teach that bishops do not have the power to institute or establish something contrary to the gospel. Now, again, keep this in mind. Again, what's his concern? The gospel and the law, as indicated above and is taught by canon law throughout the ninth distinction. Now it is patently contrary to God's command and word to make laws out of opinions or to require that by observing them, they make satisfaction for sin and obtain grace. Again, the whole point, just nail this down into your skull. Melanchthon is not concerned about people making things traditional or things not being commanded by God, things being adiaphora used for church order. That's not his concern. That might be your concern. But his concern is the gospel and the law. For the honor of Christ's merit is slandered when we take it upon ourselves to earn a grace through such ordinances. Mind you, who's doing this? Who's doing that? Nobody. Nobody right now, at least. It is obvious that because of this notion, human ordinances have multiplied beyond calculation, while teaching concerning faith and the righteousness of faith have been almost completely surpassed. Daily new festivals and new feasts have been commanded, new ceremonies, new venerations of the saints have been instituted in order that by such working of grace, the good might be earned from God. Again, what is the concern with having saints' feasts? Well, it's not that it honors human beings. It's not that it honors God's work through human beings. The concern that the Book of Concord has is that we would be doing it like medieval Roman Catholics, thinking that by doing it, we earn justification by meriting good works of attending church services. This is not a view that we have. I'm sorry. This is not, right? So when we try and make these things in-house Lutheran issues, we're not even in the same playing field. We're not even in the same ballpark as what Melanchthon's critiquing here. Right? So whenever you go on Facebook and you see Lutherans arguing, should you use incense? No. Incense is too Roman Catholic. Should you have a saint's feast? No, we don't want to have saints' feasts. We don't want to have sanctoral cycles. Why? Well, this is too Roman Catholic and you don't want to honor men. You don't want to do traditions of men. That's not the concern of the Augsburg Confession. It's not the concern of the Book of Concord, right? Moreover, those who institute human ordinances act also contrary to God's command when they attach sin to food, day, similar things, and burden Christian consciences with the law, at their own man-made laws, as if the divine ones weren't enough. As if, in order to earn God's grace, there had to be such service of God among Christians, like the Levitical service. Again, the exact same point, right? To say that not having incense is a sin, we can't have that. To say that using incense merits the forgiveness of sin, we can't have that. This does not say we can't have incense. By the way, incense isn't even of human tradition. It's commanded by God of the Old Testament, right? So we can't say it's like a merely human thing either. And all this coming back to that point of people will say, oh, the end of the Augsburg Confession is really not about, it's not about theology, it's not about faith, it's about praxis. That's entirely incorrect. As you see, I hope you see the entirety of the disputations in the Augsburg Confession, that is the end of the Augsburg Confession, is about two things: the forgiveness of sins freely given through the blood of Christ, and the law of God. That's it. That's it, right? And then it's applied to different things. So what's Melanchthon opposing here? Well, he's not opposing here that we have feasts. He's not opposing that we have good order in the church. He's opposing, and he's not opposing bishops in this sense of the three guys touching the head of the other guy. Right? We're talking about Melanchthon is talking about when you make the regulations and rules and good orders to be for the meriting of justification, for the validity of the sacrament, for preserving yourself from sin of not doing it. And all of this is just coming back down to the cross of Jesus Christ. Now he says, this is how countless ordinances came into being. For example, that it is supposed to be mortal sin to do manual labor on festivals. This is that Sabbath idea, by the way, even when it offends no one else. And that it is also a mortal sin to omit the seven hours, that is the liturgy of the hours, to say, for example, if you do not pray sext or none, then you did a sin, right? You say that this is not true, right? That some foods defile the conscience, that fasting is a work that appeases God, that in reserve, and by the way, this appeases, you need to say appeases, not pleases. Does fasting please God? Does self-discipline please God? Yes. Does he will that you beat your bodies into submission? Yes. Does he will that you practice mortification of sin? Yes. But does it appease his wrath? No. Right? No. And why no? Because nothing could other than the perfect merit, perfect satisfaction of the blood of Jesus Christ, God in flesh. Now, he says also that in a reserve case, sin is not forgiven unless one first asks to be forgiven of the person for whom the case is reserved, despite the fact canon laws do not speak of the reservation of guilt, but only of the reservation of church penalties. Again, that's a penance issue, right? Okay, so I think we'll pause there on paragraph at the end of paragraph 41, where just before Melanchthon starts talking about where did this idea come from. Now, this I want you to notice this is a very long sort of article or paragraph or chapter, whatever, 78 long, and then probably look at the conclusion. But what have we seen here? The same thing that we've seen in the rest of the disputations in the Augsburg Confession is we want to make forgiveness of sin freely given in the blood of Christ. We want to make sure people know it's not a sin to not do Vespers, even though it's dumb to not do it, right? We want to make sure that people understand the distinction between meriting forgiveness of sin, meriting justification, and doing what's good for you, right? You should still do what's good for you. You should still do what's good for church order. You should still pray the hours. You should. It's not a sin to not do it. You should do it, right? It's not a sin to not go to the saints' feast, but you should do it. It's not a sin to not go to Bible study, but you should do it, right? And doing these things doesn't merit forgiveness, but doing a lot of these things will bring you face to face with forgiveness. Because what are these things about? Are these things bad for you? Are we saying, yeah, you should smoke crack? No, we're not. We're saying you should go to church, you should read the Bible, you should pray, you should immerse yourself in the promises of God. That's not a bad thing. And people who are saying it's a bad thing are bad people. Okay? Get that through your head. God bless you all. Blessed Epiphany. Blessed 2026. And hopefully next week, my mind will be sharper and I can bring to you some more rich material from the Augsburg Confession. God bless you all.